Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hey, everybody. We have a great one today, you know, for a change. If you're a regular listener to this weekly broadcast, you probably heard me say that I didn't want to do news of the day. And what I meant by that is you get that elsewhere. If you want to hear about what's happening in politics, inside baseball, horse race, that kind of thing, or, you know, what's happening in the news that day, you can get that from a lot of sources, some more edifying, some more to this taste or that. But you can spend 25 hours a day being marinated in today's news. See, what I wanted to do is create evergreen shows that you could listen to a year later. I'll give you an example. During the Kavanaugh hearings, I did a podcast with Jeffrey Toobin and Nancy Gertner of Harvard Law on the Federalist Society and its history and what it's become and how dangerous it is. And I think it's completely fresh and educational and thought-provoking and actually very funny show, if I do say so myself. And then the next week, I could move on to Michael Lewis and his brilliant book, The Fifth Risk, about how, because Trump had no interest in government, he had populated his agencies with a bunch of incompetent, venal, and self-interested toadies, and how that might mean that they would not be prepared for the fifth risk, which is the unforeseen calamity that his government misses entirely and that they don't focus on. And in that conversation, we touched on Trump's getting rid of the Directorate for Global Health and Security and Biodefense within the National Security Council. Uh-oh. Well, this pandemic is now not just the news of the day, of every day, it's now the news of the century. So it looks like this is the thing I'm going to focus on for the remainder of the century. Now, when I was in the Senate, I got to know Tony Fauci and Ron Klain, but I spent more time on the phone with Tom Frieden, director of the CDC, and so many of the impressive, dedicated people who are leading the charge against the Ebola crisis. However, during my time overlapping the Trump administration, I did not meet with Jared Kushner, who has taken a much-needed break from his work bringing peace to the Middle East to focus his efforts leading the White House task force on the coronavirus pandemic. So I did not get to know Ali Sharif Al-Ahmadi, Qatar's finance minister, who helped arrange Qatar's $1 billion bailout of the Kushner family's 666 Fifth Avenue, Turkey. You know, we miss the brilliant, dedicated folks who populated the Obama administration. One of them is Austin Goolsbee, chairman of Obama's Board of Economic Advisors. I am so pleased to have Austin back on. This time, each of us is sheltered in our respective homes, his being in Illinois, where he is a professor at the University of Chicago Business School. Now, in the interview, I think you'll see why Professor Goolsbee is a great guest. He's not just a brilliant economist, but someone who explains pretty sophisticated concepts in a way that are immediately accessible and fascinating. And he brings to all that a real clear-eyed common sense and decency that I think will make him a national treasure. However, Austin's one failing in this interview is his inability or unwillingness to accept that Donald Trump is crazy. And you'll hear this a few times during the interview where Austin just cannot understand why Trump won't just acknowledge that the federal government was a little slow in addressing the crisis and develop a test that could have been widely administered. So we got a little behind the eight ball there, and that he needs to do things like use the Defense Production Act to manufacture critical medical supplies to overcome shortages of equipment and devices such as masks and gowns and ventilators. Austin would make the point that people root for leaders during times of crisis and respect ones who acknowledge mistakes but then act to correct them in order to save people's lives. And you will hear me make the case repeatedly that he is unable to do that because he is clinically insane. He has something called narcissistic personality disorder. And I acknowledge that I am not a psychiatrist, nor have I personally examined the president. But there is absolutely no doubt that he is mentally ill, that he is just bonkers. And this is a case I make strongly in my new piece entitled The President is Crazy, which you can find on my website, alfranken.com. But you'll see in the last half of the interview, Austin, I think, demonstrates how someone who is absolutely brilliant can be stupid about something, which is he cannot understand why Trump doesn't start doing what makes sense for the country and for himself. Now, we did this interview right after Congress had passed the huge $2 trillion bill, and that's where you'll pick up. The $2 trillion package, let's just start there. I don't know how much you have absorbed, but let's go right to how helpful is this going to be in the next week, in the next 2 weeks? Is it helping the right people? Is there money going out to the wrong people? What do you see here?
Obviously, that stimulus bill is the big headline, but the backup second headline is the unemployment claims data came out, and it's by far the worst of all times.
3.2 million, is that what it is?
Yeah, almost 3.3 million. You know, so the most people filed for unemployment insurance this week by far than have ever filed. It's the worst week in the history of job destruction in the United States. And it's probably just the beginning. And that puts the focus back on the main headline of, well, what is that bill about and what is it trying to do? It's wrong to call it a stimulus. It's not a conventional stimulus. Stimulus like 2009 is you're in a normal recession. The government tries to do things to generate spillover activity in the private economy. We're going to give a tax cut. We're going to have direct spending. We're going to do stuff that that creates more activity and more jobs. This is really relief. Everybody's going to batten down the hatches.
And that's what we need. I mean, that's what we need.
Yeah, I think it is what we need. The spirit of that is what we need.
Right.
So it's $2 trillion. And if you look, there's hundreds of billions of dollars that are going to things that I would characterize we less need.
You know, let me guess, the cruise industry.
Yeah, look, cruise industry. We're gonna single out airlines alone to get a special $25 billion or some benefit.
And how much does that go, for example, to help the folks that are being laid off by the airlines?
We'll have yet to see that.
Mm-hmm. You haven't read the 900 pages?
Well, what matters is what are the airlines going to do? And in all of the business side stuff where they're in addition to the loans to some industries, there's about $280 billion of further corporate tax cuts. And there's going to be this question, what do they do with the money? And just in a similar way of the last tax cut, what are they going to do with the money?
Hopefully they've written some safeguards, because that was clear as day. There was going to be, it was most of it was going to be a stock buyback. So that's prohibited with this money, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, they if you take loans, I think they will not let you take direct bailout money and use it for buybacks. But if you cut the employer side of the payroll tax, there are some detailed provisions that basically they magnified some of the tax cuts from the Trump tax cut bill. They made them bigger. They made them easier to use. And I don't think there's any restrictions on that money. If you save money on taxes and you decide you want to pay it out in a dividend or more executive compensation or however you want to pay it out, I don't think, as the economists say, money is fungible. And so I think you can use that money for however you want.
And I guess they will want to buy back their stock because it must be low now or something. Is that a perverse incentive or something?
I don't know. Look, I think of that stock buybacks is basically like paying a dividend. It's just a way to distribute money to the shareholders. I would hope that the companies put in this, it is a very tough spot that all of business and workers are going to be in for a couple of months here. And I will hope that they wouldn't just go back to previous habits when what we really need, as I say, is relief. I mean, what we need is some forbearance or relief or hit the pause button, however you want to describe it.
I mean, obviously, giving people unemployment insurance, sending cash to people.
Yeah. Look, that's a lot. There's kind of multiple parts. One is they're going to mail checks to almost everybody. You know, there's caps on income, which there should be. Part is through unemployment insurance. So if you lose your job, you get some payments. Part is standing up lending facilities, they call it, work with the Fed so that small businesses, medium-sized businesses could come get emergency loans with low or no interest and very generous terms of payback. Some of it is explicit bailout money or sizable cuts to corporate taxes, trying to give tax relief. And then there is a component, maybe less than 10% of the total, which is money to hospitals, money to states.
It would seem that money to hospitals and equipment to hospitals is our highest priority. Now, basically, let's talk about the coronavirus and basically why we're here and how this package relates to how we go forward. Because the president, who I contend is nuts, and one day he says one thing and one day he says another, or for a month he was over a month saying one crazy thing, which is this is not a problem, everything's under control, we're down to almost zero people sick, all that stuff. And then he'll come back and sound sane because somebody convinced him to do the right thing, and then he'll just veer right back and he wants us in the pews in Easter. It's on display every day that the man has a problem, and we get to watch it every friggin' day because he has to do this because he can't do rallies. So he has to stand up there, and instead of saying, okay, let's do this someplace else, let's have Fauci do this, let's have those people do it. So what the president now is talking about is us going back out there and the infection spiking if we do that, right?
Yeah, and there's so much to unpack and talk about in what you just said. I mean, first, it's totally obvious that if somehow the president could control it and he went to everyone in America and said, hey, you know what? It's Easter weekend. Let's all go out and party and go out. Let's go back to, you know, sports games and go to restaurants the way we were doing before. Every public health expert and epidemiologist in the country says that would lead to a mass round of infections and we'll be back to square one where we got to go back into lockdown to try to stop the thing spreading. At a deeper level, I guess I'm puzzled by why the president loves to be the hero of the story, loves to have a TV show where he's the good guy and is the winner. There is historically such a huge wellspring of support of the American people for its leaders during a crisis. They crave leadership from their political figures at a moment like this, even among people of the opposite party. And you see this in New York. You know, Governor Cuomo gets up, has a sober briefing each day, every couple of days, where he just tells the truth and tries to be consistent. And you see Republicans in New York say, well, I never liked him, but he's doing a good job now. And Rudy Giuliani, same thing in New York City after 9/11. So if President Trump had just played it straight, I actually think that the American people would have responded quite positively to that. And in a way, the political campaign of 2020 would have taken a back seat. And I'm sure there would be a lot of Democrats who would be frustrated. And they say, oh, he's not as good as he seems at these press conferences. Instead, I think it's because the president has such a short run mentality, he couldn't look past that. So you see the pandemic break out in China. And the thing about infectious diseases is they don't stay in one place, you know, because people move around, they bring it with them. And so it went from China to Korea. The South Koreans had an ideal best of world response to the outbreak of the crisis with lots of testing, and they were able to avoid going into total lockdown the way we have. And we went for probably almost 8 weeks with the president, as you say, downplaying not just the severity of the crisis, downplaying the existence of the crisis. No, there's only 14 cases here. It's going to be zero. They're finding that they just get better. They can go back to work.
Yeah, it just disappears. They can go to work even if they're infected.
It was terrible. And it literally costs thousands of people their lives anywhere that the leaders have downplayed this and allowed the infection to spread.
Anywhere in the world. But here, and then he is such a sick person that he won't acknowledge that at all. So, you know, whatever he says on Tuesday, on Wednesday, that doesn't matter.
My old mentor and friend, Paul Volcker, would always say that when the crisis begins, the only asset you have is your credibility.
I've used that a lot and not cited Paul Volcker.
Yeah, we should cite Paul Volcker because he would say that through the financial crisis, and it really applies in all crises.
And he has no credibility.
You know, let's have multiple versions of what our strategy is right out of the gate. In a way, this was the thing that set back in the 2008 crisis at the end of the Bush administration. The bottom just starts to drop out. And so if you remember, they come forward and they say, oh, you know what? We want this money. We're going to do a TARP and we're going to buy up toxic assets. And people say, wait a minute, what? How could you do that? And then they say, okay, we're not going to buy toxic assets. We're going to overpay for these assets. And they say, that won't work. And they say, okay, we're going to put money into the banks. And I don't think that much was put on the fact that if you have three strategies in the first 3 weeks, you demonstrate you don't know what you're doing. And that sets back your credibility and that makes it extremely hard to try to fix things. And it feels to me like President Trump is reliving that. Okay, so if you say it's nothing, and then you say it's important, and then you're back to saying, I think we should all go out by Easter, it dramatically undermines the credibility of your policy response, so that whatever you say, people are thinking, well, wait a minute, in 2 weeks, is it going to be something totally different? Like, this is totally different than it was 2 weeks previously. And I think that's a real problem. They've got to stop doing that.
I think that's an enormous problem now. And people have been saying, look, the president, it was awful. At the beginning, he played this down. He ignored it. People are going to lose their lives because this, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe even over a million, could be just tracked back to us not doing anything for basically 2 months. But they say, but let go of that. Let's just go forward. I would love to do that, but every day he's doing it again.
Yes.
So what we need is basically he's going to do these because he can't do rallies. So he is an egomaniac and he has to have an audience. That's what gets him juiced up. So he's doing these every day. And then we have to watch this spectacle and everybody has to, you know, Fauci has to see this naked emperor at the podium and not say the president is naked, or say it in a very, very diplomatic way.
It's what I don't get. Why does the emperor have to be naked? That's what. Why doesn't Donald Trump come out to his press briefings and just tell it straight and talk to the policy advisors and say, here's what's happening? And why are you laughing? Why doesn't he do that? I don't understand.
You have to understand he's crazy. That's all. That's the answer to your question. He is a malignant narcissist. I'm not a psychiatrist and I've not personally examined the man, but he has a disorder, and it is that whatever he says, it doesn't matter. And he's up there and I got this 8 minutes covered. I got the next 8 minutes covered. I know what I'm going to say.
That's totally what it seems like. And now evidently he's upset at Governor Cuomo and Governor Pritzker because they're getting too good a press. And my thing is, so fine, do what they do. Just get up and tell the truth. But the American people want this.
Austin, give it up. This shows you how stupid, incredibly smart people can be. He can't do that, Austin. You're a great economist. You're chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under Barack Obama. There's something you're not getting here. He's incapable of doing this.
You're right. He just will not do that.
So the point is, we're just going to have to do this. They're going to cover it. And the whole Fauci drama is there because Fauci, I wrote something where I compared it to Salieri and Mozart. And Fauci's Mozart and the president is Salieri. He's a bitter hack and a manipulative bitter hack. And then you got this genius who has this gift of having integrity and also being brilliant. And there's this tension always there, which is what I'm looking for, which is, you know, Fauci came close. He said, I can't shove him out of the way, you know, when he's saying something that's not true. And then you didn't see him the next day. But now he's back. But I swear to God that this is going to be the show to watch. How long Fauci can do this job that he's doing, and knowing that in the background he's helping, any kind of reaching this guy helps, but he can't reach him because he is so deranged. So the tension to me is going to be the president is going to continue to say things that are not true, and Fauci is going to have to stand there and either wince or flinch or roll his eyes.
Hold his head. You've seen him holding his head. The only thing I'll say, Al, is I think that the short-term self-aggrandizement mentality that the president is taking, I think in a way it's going to be made moot very rapidly, because we're not yet to the peak of this health crisis. And you've literally now got hospitals in New York, which in some ways is the epicenter of the crisis, you've got them with so little protective equipment, they're literally putting on garbage bags to protect themselves. Once the ICUs are full and our emergency rooms and hospitals look like what they did in Italy, where there's elderly and middle-aged and young people dying in the halls because they can't get a bed or a ventilator, I think the American people are going to be so upset with the images that they see and their own relatives and how ill they are. I think there's going to be massive pressure on the president at that point to stop goofing off and actually fix these problems.
Okay, hold that thought. We got to take a break. We'll be right back with Austin Goolsbee. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
The worst thing he's doing now is calling for people to fill the pews in Easter. And I guess he's done a caveat. We will see. But basically, this is what a number of people are calling for, which is, it's like, we don't want the cure to be worse than the disease. And so they're saying, let's just, in 15 days, let's get out there. And of course, that's a disaster, because then we spike again. And this disaster started with not reacting or making bad decisions on testing, et cetera, et cetera. I want to know how we decide when to leave, when to stop sheltering in place. I'm sure everybody who knows anything about how these diseases work is saying we don't know yet. But boy, Easter is ridiculous.
That's certainly what it seems like to me. I mean, Easter, how many days away is that? The president said more. He said Easter. Before that, he was like, oh, I don't want to wait a month. He said, you know, I'm talking about weeks, not months. One of two things have to happen to get out of lockdown. Number one, you must see the rate of spread of the virus falling substantially, which we haven't seen. It's still going up at pretty rapid rates. Or you have to have comprehensive testing so that people can go back to work who know they don't have the disease, and it's very unlikely that they're just going to bump into somebody and catch it because that person hasn't been tested and doesn't know. That's what happened in Korea. They had extensive testing, and they've incorporated technology. They started on it right out of the gate. And they aren't in lockdown. That's the thing. They're not in lockdown in Korea. Their economy can come back because the only people that have to go into isolation are the people who test positive. And then they contact anybody whose phone was close to the phone of that person. They send them a text. They say, you need to go get tested now. And those people go to a drive-through test and they get the results back in minutes, not days or weeks. And that's the way you get out of lockdown.
That's right. But we can't do that because we're very late to the testing game. That's put us on this trajectory. So we have to absorb exactly what's in this bill that passed. And are there some good things in it, you see, and some bad things. But the bottom line is that this economy doesn't start going until we get a handle on the virus. And because we didn't have the testing, we've been flying blind.
Yes.
And so we got to get up to testing, and we've got to let this play out to a point where letting people out to get the economy going, we have to be extremely careful about how we do that.
Totally. And look, what we need to stop happening while we do this is they need to stop giving us the official information being wrong over and over. Okay, so this thing with testing, we messed up the first 6 to 8 weeks. But then everyone recognized that testing was a huge bottleneck and that we needed to fix it. And if you remember, Vice President Pence, who is in charge of the task force, made a public announcement that they were going to have 4 million tests out by March 13th. There haven't been 4 million tests sent out to this day. So stop saying that. Just start telling us what the actual truth is, and people can handle it. We just need to get the correct information.
And okay, again, that's not going to happen.
I'm telling you, keep saying that, but it has to. It has to happen.
Let's just assume it doesn't, because come on. You know, when you assume, you make an ass out of Uma Thurman. You know that. Okay, so here's my question. You're an economist, okay? What is the wisest course of action to get our economy going, in your view? That's in terms of, one, how long we stay locked down, but it's also look at workers. Let's look at companies. Are there companies being bailed out that shouldn't be?
Yeah, look, probably. As I say, you know, giving money to casinos and cruise lines, those are not the backbone of the economy. If you're going to give special
treatment. Well, casinos are the backbone of Donald Trump's.
Yeah, you know, like these are businesses that Trump knows about. So he says, I want special money. That said, the thing about virus economics is that by far the most important thing you can do for the economy is anything that slows the spread of the virus. And that's why I favored early on things that by conventional measures are not stimulus, are the opposite, like paid sick leave so that people that are sick don't come to work. Now, in a normal calculus, that's actually negative on GDP growth because you pay people not to come to work, so they don't produce. But the thing is, the data from the flu seasons has shown that that's actually a very effective policy at slowing the rate of spread of infectious disease because the people who are sick don't feel like they have to come in to put food on the table to get a paycheck.
Okay, and what is the paid sick leave? How is that addressed in this bill?
There's not a whole lot on paid sick leave in the bill. This bill is a relief bill. It's not really, I think it's not fully a whole because there is some money, but the thing that's lacking in this bill, I love the relief. It's vitally necessary. I love the forbearance. There are a lot of creative ideas in it. It's not fundamentally and primarily about fighting the virus. You would think that we would mobilize the powers granted to the executive branch by our law that give them the right in emergency and wartime to mobilize production for the kinds of resources you need to protect national security, now would be the moment. This is the moment when you break out the emergency bourbon, whatever it is. And I can't understand why we're not doing that.
This is Pearl Harbor, and we should be... You say this is virus economics?
Yeah.
It's exactly what it is. Now, how does virus economics differ from normal economics?
The main difference is that you got to address the virus before you can do anything about the economics. So virus economics says anything that slows the rate of spread of that virus allows us to get out of lockdown. And when we're in general lockdown, of course, the economy is going to be in a horrible spot. I wrote a thing in the New York Times before anything really started, got going in the U.S., in which I pointed out, if we get a health outbreak here of the magnitude of what they had in China, it's going to be worse for our economy than it was for China. And it was pretty horrible for China because more of our economy is all of these service sector industries, which are exactly the things that go into shutdown mode when people are afraid to go out and interact with each other. This face-to-face business is exactly why we set the all-time record for unemployment insurance this week. And it's because people don't want to go out of their houses if they think they're going to get a disease that is going to kill them or their family members who are at risk. And so I think we've must redouble our efforts and do everything we can on that front. And that doesn't just mean focusing on the infection part. If we had treatments, if we had vaccines, if you had the feeling that there is a lower bound, that it won't get worse than X, anything like that is actually the best stimulus there is. Now, category two are things like what are in this, what they're calling a stimulus bill, but is I think of as a relief bill. We do need relief in a moment like this. In a way, it's like the, you know, the beach town in the wintertime or something. We need to board up the windows, shut it down, and nobody starve and nobody have permanent damage if we can avoid it from what's a temporary shutdown. And then category three is let's try to juice this thing and get back to something like where we were before. And what I fear is that the administration, at the least, and also a lot of members of Congress, are basically like, let's minimize one, let's do some of two, but really, let's get to three. Let's get to juice the economy and get this thing back to running. Let's have tax cuts, you know, give companies more money. And that's what leads to investment. You know, the Fed will cut the interest rate to zero and we'll have a big boom. But of course, we won't have a boom.
Why would anybody invest anything now when there's all this uncertainty? This shouldn't be about a stimulus. This should be about getting past this.
I agree.
And making sure that people can eat.
I agree.
They can stay in their home, that businesses can retain employees. That's what this needs to be about. And that's what a lot of it is about, I think, right?
A lot of this relief package is about that, but it's kind of wrapped in this language of stimulus, and it's stapled to some ideas which aren't that. They are just old-fashioned tax cuts are what get things moving. And the Fed is doing what it should do, but anybody who thinks that the Fed cutting the interest rate to 0% and buying up various kinds of bonds to try to get other interest rates low, if they think that that's going to get the economy to come back, I think they're kidding themselves, because a cruise line is not going to buy another ship because the interest rate is low. I mean, we've got to get a handle on this virus. That's the number one thing for both life, keeping our citizens alive, and for the economy.
You know what? The name of this bill should have been the Pay Your Nut Bill. And basically that, like, every business, every American should have their nut paid. In other words, how much does it take me to survive during this 10-week period, this whatever this period is. And we don't know what it is, and that's why we don't know really what the size of the package should be. But the shape of it should reflect virus economics, which is, this is our first virus economics, right?
Yeah, pretty much, of the modern era.
Yeah, and the modern era has a different economy than we had during World War One and in the Spanish flu.
Totally right.
Right? Yep. Yeah. So the point is that what's in this that's going to help carry us over, and what is not in this that isn't going to do it, and what is the best course of action over, and we don't know whether this is 10 more weeks, 8 more weeks, 13 more weeks. We don't exactly know. But the smartest course of action would be to allow people to eat, allow people to pay their mortgage, allow people to stay in their dwelling. That's it, isn't it?
Yes. Look, I think that's right. I have seen the epidemiologists suggest that with no abatement, as they call it, that is, everybody just goes out and does what they did before, you could get 140 million people caught the virus in the United States. And if we had total lockdown everywhere, you could limit the total spread of the virus to, I think it was something like 15 million people. So 135 million people incrementally would get the disease from the worst outcome versus following the best practices.
And I've actually seen some, I don't know, conservatives, Republicans, whatever, saying like, you know what? If people over 70 die, one, kind of good for solvency of Social Security. Two, those are the worst years of your life. Let's face it. I'm trying to think of what three could be because I'm trying to put myself in their head.
Anybody who says that, you would think that they would be ashamed. And whose parents are 70 years old, or are they themselves 70 years old, or grandparents? I mean, the thought that we're just going to write off people's lives because, you know, we want the stock market to be higher seems unbelievable to me. And maybe it's just a sign that some people care so much about their partisan thing that they will literally say anything just because the president asked them to say that. I have no idea, but that's bonkers. But separate from getting in a moral argument about it, it's just not even good economics. If your thing is, hey, let's let 70-year-olds die to fix the economy, this isn't fixing the economy. It's back to my thing of the emperor has no clothes. Why does the emperor have to have no clothes? Why doesn't the emperor just put on regular clothes like a normal person and recognize that if you slow the rate of spread of this virus and you get the tests out there and you invoke the Defense Mobilization Act or whatever it's called, and you make ventilators and you make masks and you make respirators, you can do what they did in South Korea, which is get your economy out of lockdown and back to growing. And it's so how short-sighted can we be? This isn't, I'm not saying that the president should do something that's not in his own interest. I'm saying the president doing the right thing is in his best interest. They're well,
that's
just
one way
so
to look
short-sighted.
At it.
It's opposing their own interest.
He's crazy. That's I just keep coming back to that. Don't expect anything of us. So the rest of us, and like they took action in the Senate, and we're gonna. It's gonna take a long time to figure out, you know, what they put in there that Mnuchin is gonna do, what the oversight of that is going to be, what the transparency of that is going to be. I suspect that we're gonna see some really hinky stuff when we look back on this. But the question is, are people going to be able to survive? Are they going to be able to eat? Are they going to be able to stay in their homes? And that's kind of it. And are businesses going to be able to not go bankrupt? And can they survive this period where there's very little economic activity in their whatever it is they do, because they have a place where, you know, they have a factory where a lot of people are working. Well, you can't do that. You can't fly planes. But I would think that the best thing to do is to keep those mechanics, those flight attendants, those pilots, to keep them eating and in their homes and being able to get medical attention again, you know, and also being able to find a way to take care of kids. I know that my grandchildren are sheltering with their parents. That's happening all over the country. And that's, I think that's the bottom line. If we do that properly, and if we have the tests and we can track who is infected, then at a certain point we come out the end of this and boom, we go.
That's what we want. And I think we can do that. This bill that hopefully is going to, you know, is passed the Senate. Let's hope we can get through. Has a lot of things that, at least in the short run, are going to help ensure that everybody can keep food on the table. They're going to try to keep small and medium sized businesses from going under. They're trying to encourage them to keep workers on the payroll, and that's what they should be doing. It does have some money that goes to hospitals, some money that goes to states. To my mind, not near enough. And it staples in then some more questionable stuff. Like I say, some corporate tax incentives and corporate tax cuts. We've got big lending facilities that could work, but if they have, in your lovely phrase, some hinky stuff in there, my fear is the political delegitimization of relief is the risk. That the longer this goes, you know that they'll have to come back for more if we cannot solve the virus or contain its spread. And if we pass $2 trillion, I mean, 10% of GDP, this is the biggest stimulus of all times as a share of the economy, bigger than the Obama stimulus, bigger than the New Deal as a share of the economy. If we do that, and then we come back in however many months or weeks and say, we need to do more. And the general feeling is, well, the first round didn't do very much, and a whole bunch of it ended up going to cruise lines or, you know, people who didn't deserve it. Or if the companies that got the corporate rate cuts do not use it to keep people on the payroll, they instead use it to shore up their balance sheet and let people go. I think there would be a real question of whether our politics is going to be able to commit to provide relief for as long and in the amounts that we would need. And so that makes me even more impatient and want them to put the number one focus on confronting the virus and slowing down the spread of that virus. Because only through that method can you reduce the amount of money and the amount of time that we're going to need this relief. Because I fear, given our experience with stimulus the last time, I fear the longevity. You know, what's the life expectancy of people's willingness to just keep paying monetary relief? I don't know if it's going to be there.
I mean, if you look at the polling about who's taking this seriously and how seriously they're taking it, there's a big difference between Republicans and Democrats. The Republicans in the Senate, the first package they wrote was unacceptable. Thank God the Democrats didn't give them the votes to pass it. This compromise is a compromise. But if these Republicans start going like, nope, we got to send people out there. We got to tell people, go ahead. But it's the governors, isn't it? Isn't the governors? They're
yeah, look, it's right? The governors. Well, there is a chance that we get back into this into this dynamic, like with the Affordable Care Act, where it's like the blue states all expand Medicaid and the red states say, no, we're not going to extend health insurance. But I'm closetly optimistic on this front. I think the only reason that we're having this discussion in public now is because we have yet to reach the peak of the health part of this crisis. And when that happens, that part is going to be awful. But when that happens, I'm optimistic nobody's going to be getting up and saying this anymore of like, let's all just go back out and interact with each other face to face again, because I think it's going to be so clear how dangerous this virus is that we will just have a pivot. And I'm hopeful that when we pivot, that the president, I know you keep laughing at me and saying that the president is crazy and he won't do this, but I really think that if the images on TV are of how dangerous and deadly this virus is, I think they're going to change their tune. They're not going to be talking about, I want everybody to go to church on Easter and sit next to each other. I think they will, in a way, equally infuriatingly, they will start to say, no, I never said that. From the beginning, I've been saying we need to get ventilators in every hospital and we need to get protective equipment. And let's hope that we get to that spot where it aligns, where the interests of saving lives and saving the economy align with the administration's political interests so that they start doing what we need to do to recover both health-wise and economic-wise. Right now, we're not yet there. And that's a dangerous contradiction of priorities. That's the thing that makes me the most uneasy right now. But I do think we're going to get off of that. And when we do, that's probably going to raise the president's approval rating. And we should be for that. We need the president to succeed here. We can't. The president is failing at some of the fundamental aspects of crisis leadership. And we can't afford him to fail. We need him to succeed. He needs to grow into the job. Right now, it doesn't really seem like he's doing that.
Do you remember when Rumsfeld, I think it was when in Kuwait, he went to Kuwait, and this was at a period, I think it's 2006, where they didn't have the armor they needed. They hadn't up-armored, their Humvees, et cetera, and these guys are getting, killed or be amputees because of that. And he said something to the effect of, you go to war with the army you have, not with the army you want. But that was longer after 9/11, that point that he did this, than VJ Day was after Pearl Harbor. And I can't understand why we don't have factories making ventilators.
Totally.
I don't understand this. You just mobilize. This is a war. It's a war with an invisible enemy. But it's a war. That's what we're on. This isn't a stimulus. Now, World War II, and that got us out of the Depression. It's unbelievable that there are nurses in garbage bags.
Unbelievable. That's exactly the right word. It's unbelievable. And
in the United States of America.
And it doesn't have to be this way. That's. I think that fundamentally what has happened is that at the highest levels, in the president himself's mind, as well as the administration, they've had a dangerous conflict of priorities. And you've seen that from the very beginning, that they'd say, what do you think about the virus? And the conflict of priorities is there was one priority, which was don't make it seem like it's important. And that manifested by don't do testing. We don't want testing because we don't want the numbers to go up. Don't take the people off the cruise ship. You remember the president said, well, the doctors say we should take those people and put them in the hospital. But I don't want to do that because then our numbers will go up. And that wasn't our fault.
That was telling.
And the fact that the president was fighting about trade war, with China up until very recently, we had tariffs on medical products coming from China and other countries. And so the pandemic breaks out. One reason why we don't have more masks, more respirators, and simple medical equipment, you know, $5 type stuff, is because we've been applying the kind of trade war priorities
to medical health, equipment.
Yeah, to medical equipment and supplies. We've been applying that mentality when we should have been more rapidly shifting our mentality to, look, all of that stuff can wait until people aren't dying.
This is a very interesting thing, I think, that we did. We did put increased tariffs on medical equipment from China. And not only that, but because it was a trade war, discouraged importing anything from China, buying stuff from China. And when did that stop?
I'm an economist, so you know I think trade wars are terrible. If you like trade wars, fine. Wait for a safer moment to have your trade war. Don't do it now. We have to get in the mentality, which is defense mobilization to fight this virus, fighting this virus, getting tests, getting masks, getting respirators, getting all of that stuff is not just how you save people's lives. It's also how you save the economy.
This is fake news, what you're giving here, because he had, when he imposed those tariffs on medical equipment from China, there was no virus. So I want to jump in here and defend Trump.
Okay, if you want to, but look, we have.
I'm trying to think.
We have had the virus. We were applying the tariffs, and the whole mentality that undergirded the decision early on that we don't want your stinking tests. We don't want those foreign tests. We're going to make our own test. That's part of the same mentality, and maybe there's a place for that mentality at some times, but when the virus is raging, the time for that mentality is done. We need the test now. We're making more tests. We still need 10x the number of tests. We should never be somebody's got some symptoms that might be COVID-19, but we're rationing the tests and saying, well, you know, you're not old enough to take a test. But that's crazy.
The irony, of course, is that if we had had that test when South Korea had their test, we probably could go back to work much sooner.
Yeah, look, by Easter, we might already have been out. In Korea, they aren't in lockdown. That's the thing. Even if you view, look, we made mistakes. We went 8 weeks. We should have been paying more attention. We should have followed the pandemic playbook, which the administration was handed. The National Security Council has a pandemic playbook. They're not following it. Fine. All of that's in the past. Starting today, let's start following the playbook. Let's go get the tests. Let's try to do exactly what we should have been doing 8 weeks ago, and let's do it today. And
you know, I hope the president is listening. He'll be going like, you know what? He's right.
He's like, I'm going to do it today. But like I say, it would make the president look better. If the president is jealous of Governor Cuomo and the press that he's getting, he can do that. Just start telling the truth, mobilize the Defense Production Act to get the respirators and the masks and the ventilators, and leave no stone. Whatever it is, I'm going to get it to you. Instead of making the governors, what's happening now is the president is making the governors compete against each other for a very small number of tests and a small amount of protective equipment. So in the standard economics, there's massive demand. There's very short supply. The prices are skyrocketing. The governors are all trying to undercut each other to get the stuff diverted to their states. Instead of doing that, every governor in America, if the president was saying, I am going to get you everything you need, every governor in America would be saying, even the Democrats would be saying, look, I've disagreed with Donald Trump in the past, but I have to say Donald Trump is doing a great job to save lives in my state. Instead, what's happening is you've got governors saying, we don't have ventilators, we don't have masks, where's the federal government? Then the president's threatening them and implicitly saying, if you want your equipment to save lives, then you got to suck up to me. We're in a bonkers place. That is a really detrimental approach. And I don't understand why the president's doing it. I mean, I guess I understand why he's doing it because it's kind of like his standard business MO. But does he not see that he would be more popular? People would be making him the hero of the story if he was adopting a more conventional approach?
Listen, do you remember when he said that John McCain was not a war hero because he got captured?
Yes.
And I like guys who weren't captured. And I thought, okay, it's over. You know. And then he would do one of those every couple of weeks. And you go, it's over. And he's president of the United States. And so he, all of this kind of behavior in his mind has been validated. I'm the most powerful person in the world, which is what I've always wanted to be. And so if you're telling me I should become a different person, you're the one who's crazy, because this has worked for me. And look at the polls now. Maybe. He's at 49%. He's as high as he's ever been. And you and I know, and the people listening know, he laughably dropped the ball. If you could laugh at any of this. And there's a hospital in New York that has a refrigerator truck there in their parking lot for a morgue.
Yeesh.
Because there's an overflow. And he's not going to change. The governors are learning, because he's a thug, and they're learning that they have to kiss up to him and say, thank you, Mr. President, for the inadequate help. Thank you, Mr. President. You are doing an amazing job. No one's done a job as good as this. And then they'll get more ventilators. And then they'll get more masks. That's the way he's operated his entire life. And so he's not going to stop. So we have to sit and watch this man do this. And those of us who are, I believe, seeing it for what it is, have to be sickened by it. That's just what it is. Occasionally, he'll land on the right thing to do. Right?
I hope so.
Well, no, but it'll be a day.
Yeah, but it'll be a day, right? It'll be infrastructure week over and over.
Sorry, we gotta go to a break right now. We'll be right back with Austin Goolsbee.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Tell me what happens if this lasts 2-3 more months. And then we have the all clear. Everybody comes out of their homes blinking because in the sunlight, and they're going like, oh, it's over. I'm going to be able to go to school, and we're all going to be able to go to work. And I love you, my neighbor, who I haven't seen. And then everybody is like, it's like Night of the Living Dead. People are out there going like, what do we do now? What happens with our economy then?
Look, hopefully, if there have not been permanent bankruptcies, liquidation type bankruptcies, hopefully we can kind of go back to doing what we were doing before. The only upside to this astronomical increase in people filing for unemployment that just came out, the biggest ever. The only upside is if something happens that's suddenly going down, maybe it could happen similarly suddenly coming back, because that's a sign this isn't a normal recession. This is a virus economics recession.
The operative word there was maybe.
Yeah, correct.
And that's what I'm asking you. You were chairman of the, you know, council, the economic advisors for the president. That's my question to you. When that happens, it feels just like things would have changed in a way that I can't wrap my brain around, but I want you to wrap your brain around and then unwrap it for our audience.
If it's in 2 months, my view is mostly it'll be fine. Let's say it wasn't 2 months. It was 8 months. Or let's say we had 2 months and then we came out, but then we got on this yo-yo until we found a vaccine where 2 months we all go out, but then we start getting it again. And then in September, vroom, here it comes back. And then we go back into lockdown again.
And that's a very likely scenario.
That's definitely a possibility. In situations like that, we're going to get stretched. We're really going to be stretching. The family budgets are going to be stretched. A lot of companies might be liquidating for good, restaurants shutting down, a whole bunch of stuff going out of business, such that when we come back, they can't just turn the lights back on and, you know, hey, take the board down out of the window. We're reopened for business. In that event, we will have a more traditional recovery struggle where we claw, scratch, try to generate activity. I would think that at that point, you would definitely want conventional stimulus to come from the government. You've seen the Fed chair going on morning television, which I think has never happened before, saying, look, the reason we're doing these lending facilities and cutting these interest rates so low is, he said, we recognize we can't solve this problem, but we want to make it as easy as possible when this problem passes, that stuff could come back as quickly as possible. If we have lengthy problems, it will be hard to do that. And we will then go back to the old saw that it's far easier to destroy a job than it is to create one, because you have to rematch. So you can tell the person, don't come to work tomorrow. But if you want someone to come to work tomorrow, you got to put out job postings. You got to find, you got to interview people. And so that's why the unemployment rate tends to go up a lot faster than it comes down. What we're hoping is that this thing being different than a regular business cycle means the unemployment rate could come down as fast as it goes up. But the longer this goes, the less true that's probably going to be.
Will our economy change forever?
I think so. You know, I think, I don't know forever, but for sure the foreseeable future, I think a lot of companies are going to be much more mindful about resilience. They probably will be hesitant to add more employment, and they want more temp workers. They want more cushion, that they'll say, hey, if a virus comes back again in the future, I don't want to be stuck on the whims of Congress supporting me. I want to be able to get as lean as I need to be as fast as I can. That's on the kind of the negative side. On the positive side, I do think that this crisis is kind of putting in people's face what we've been saying for a long time, which is there is a healthcare crisis in this country of millions of people not insured, underinsured, can't get the kind of care that they need. This reveals it. There's nothing like a serious downturn to reveal the fault lines that kind of set the stage for the next government policies. I would not be surprised if there's, on the back end of this, a much heavier push in the economy to getting everybody covered and to have more robust unemployment insurance, paid sick leave, and stuff like that. All of this has put in stark relief the rise of the gig economy, in at least some measure, was about companies trying to get the costs of benefits off of their balance sheet and put that onto the employees. And in a crisis like this, you see that doesn't really work. So I think the economy could be changed forever for the good if we recognize and try to adjust our system based on what we learned.
Let me ask you about deficits and debt, mainly debt, because when you were in the Obama administration and you saw that in Congress, especially after Republicans took over in the House in 10 and then it took the Senate in 14, but kind of all the way through, that there was this obsession from Republicans of keeping the deficit down. You know, I remember trying to get co-sponsors to really important bills that were absolutely common sense that would help people, and they would say, do you have a pay for? Do you have an offset? Where can you cut in order to have this program that is absolutely clearly a great thing, like an Indian energy, something to help Native Americans, to help these tribes have economic activity? And they would go like, well, what's your offset? And which was just mind-boggling to me, as how low my offset I needed. And nope, you got to have something that where we can cut there to pay for this, because I care about our deficit, our debt. Our debt is going to eat us, our kids alive. We're never going to be able to deal with this in the future. You saw that, right?
Yeah, and now we recognize it was totally disingenuous. We thought we were having a conversation about fiscal responsibility, and the main driver of deficits in the short run until President Trump was the business cycle. So if you had a recession, the deficit goes up because people make less, they pay less in taxes, and you got these automatic stabilizers that you got to pay for. So we have the worst recession of our lifetimes in 2007, 8, 9. The deficit goes up big time. And they say, oh, it's fiscal responsibility. You shouldn't have stimulus. You shouldn't do anything because of the deficit. And it's totally disingenuous, because you didn't need coronavirus crisis to tell you that. The first thing they do is they get in and they say, let's have a $2 trillion tax cut for big corporations, unpaid for. And they're like, yeah, that's no problem. And I was like, wait, what? You're literally the same people who just a couple of years ago told us that we can't help the unemployed. We can't do anything to try to stimulate the economy because debt is going to bury us. And now you want $2 trillion of tax cuts. The issue with deficits is not that it's going to drive up the interest rate of the United States. I don't believe in the fiscal crisis school of thought. The problem of debt and deficits is that you have to pay back the money. And so as we roll forward in the future, the more debt you have today, the more of our budget will be consumed with paying the interest on this debt instead of paying for the stuff that we really care about. And all of that said, at a moment of crisis like this, it is, in your words, this is a war. And just in the same way when we're fighting World War II, the totally wrong thing to do would be to ask, well, what's your pay for? You know, what taxes are you going to increase here to make World War II revenue neutral?
It's okay. We're landing at Normandy.
Yeah, we're landing at Normandy. What, you know, are you going to pay for the children's health insurance program? How are you going to pay for those both? And so that's the wrong thing to do.
Thank you, Austin, so much for your brilliant work. And I've been watching you out there doing God's work.
Hey, thank you for everything you've done, Al, and we always have a good time.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.